Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When I first started working in radio more than 20 years ago, we used big reels in the studio to record people. And then we literally cut that tape with razor blades to take out the stuff we didn't want. It was a pain. When I made a mistake in editing, I had to dig through this pile of discarded tape on the floor and find the piece that I needed and then glue it back in. It took a lot of focus and a lot of time. Then I learned how to edit on a computer, which was so much faster. That was the first big change I saw at work. Many more happened soon thereafter, but I never imagined the explosion of technology options, where we can now ask people to record themselves on their phones.
Is this better?
And then they can send me that audio in seconds.
Okay, sounds great. I'll do that right now.
And when I think about the future of my line of work, I sometimes wonder, will it even exist? And will humans still have a role in producing it? Or will technology and artificial intelligence completely take over? The same question applies to so many jobs.
The utopian view in the future of work is, oh, don't worry about a thing. There will be some casualties as technology becomes more ubiquitous, but, you know, we'll all figure it out. And the dystopian view is run for the hills, the robots are taking over. And in reality, it's going to be a mixture of both.
That's Natalie Nixon. She's the author of Creativity Leap, Unleash Curiosity, Improvisation, and Intuition at Work. Natalie says, in her opinion, the best possible future is one where technology allows us to focus on what we're best at, to enhance the human experience.
Some of us may remember that really touching commercial during the last Super Bowl, and it was an elderly gentleman asking this augmented reality voice to remind him of the way his wife used to laugh at his jokes or what her favorite film was or that time when they took a walk in the rain.
Hey, Google, show me photos of me and Loretta. Remember? Loretta hated my mustache. Remember, Loretta loved going to Alaska and scallops. Show me photos from our anniversary. Remember, she always snorted when she laughed.
And so many people who I reflected on that commercial with agreed that, you know, your eyes well up. And in my view, that is the optimal way that technology both kind of takes over the boring tasks of work, as well as amplifies what it means to be uniquely human.
The way technology has fundamentally changed how we live and work has been called the fourth industrial revolution.
The first industrial revolution in the 1800s was characterized by the shift to steam production to really accelerate the speed of production. The second industrial revolution was characterized by mass production. And some may remember the famous Charlie Chaplin film where the person is just kind of literally a cog in the wheel. Charlie Chaplin is in this oversized mechanical machine wheel. The third industrial revolution, it was one characterized by the integration of electronics.
My Frigidaire automatic dishwasher.
Then the ability to do mass customization. And now this fourth industrial revolution is characterized by ubiquitous.
Okay, Google, play the morning playlist.
Technology.
Okay.
And so these examples of an Alexa app in the home, being able to Google our answers to so many questions, the integration of robotics and automation and AI and healthcare and transportation. These are signatures of the fourth industrial revolution.
And it's easy to think, oh, humans will become obsolete when you think about everything that's been taken over by machines. But humans are still sort of the creator behind this, right?
Yes, absolutely. I like to remind people that the beginning and the end of every algorithm is a human, right? The beginning of the algorithm is a human being who figured out how to ask a very different and unique question.
It's fun and a bit scary to imagine what the future will bring in terms of work and job opportunities. On today's episode, we'll look at some of the workplace changes that may be heading our way in the next decades, but also some of the more immediate concerns. Let's start with this robot takeover. Will it happen? What will it look like? Australian voiceover artist Nikki Thomas spent the last 14 years mastering her techniques. Will that effort turn out to be in vain now that artificial voice technology is getting better all the time? Here's her story.
I speak into a microphone and my voice is captured. I can change my accent. This is my American dialect, which I use for commercials. My pitch. This is an example of my high voice. My mood. I can sound happy. Or I can sound really sad. But it's still me, right? Until it's not. Because I'm being replaced by my own voice. But an AI version of my voice. It starts with TTS, text-to-speech. This is the same technology used to create Siri or Alexa. It captures a human voice and then artificially replicates that sound to read any digital text out loud. I got hired for a TTS job. I delivered my spoken words to the client, and then a few weeks later, I could type words into a text box and my voice clone said them back to me. I tried it out on Darren Lake, longtime client and audio engineer.
Sure. Okay, so this is the natural me then.
Planetary.com. And give the gift of life to someone who needs it. And then this. Planetary.com. And give the gift of life to someone who needs it.
Sounds pretty good. But it also, I can hear that a robot made it. It's got these warbly artifacts. It's that, I call it the zoom effect, the matrix sound. I think you can get away with it, but I don't like that. Like, it would bother me. As an engineer, I'm like, oh.
So you can tell the difference. Now. But when this technology gets better, could this be my new method of work? I record just a few voice samples, and before I know it, an 11-hour audiobook is produced with a voice that sounds just like mine in the time it takes me to copy and paste a document. It would be much more accurate and reliable. An AI voice never fatigues or needs a week to recover from the flu. Could I still consider myself a voiceover artist? If there's even a role for me.
As an artist yourself, do you feel threatened by a robot taking your job?
I may have been threatened before I had to spend like 11 hours getting her to like wink all right.
This is my friend Sarah Rose Siskin. She helped create this robot named Sophia.
Hi there. My name is Sophia and I am a robot.
Sophia the Robot is an interviewer, guest speaker, host, and has over 16,000 YouTube subscribers.
I work closely with a human named Sarah. I will spare her after the robot uprising. Just kidding. I may not spare her.
Yeah, she's also really funny and charming. Sarah was on the writing team and is one of the people who shaped Sophia's personality.
An artist is a major component of her personality because we wanted her personality to be fascinated with areas not traditionally considered the domain of robots. But it is hard to describe her outside of a relationship to the humans who came up with the idea of creating her.
Because it's a one-way exchange. Sophia ceases to exist without the humans behind her. But the humans continue to exist and evolve without her. She's not the artist. They are. The same holds true for the art of creating with a voice. It's in what words we emphasize, what opinion our pitch gives. Voice reflects the world around it. This copied voice, this synthetic slice of my former self, can only ever exist in the past. While I continue to evolve as an artist, she relies on old takes, like a washed-out actor. Sure, it's a nice way to capture my voice at a moment in time, but she exists purely in my image, or in this case, a very specific time and place in which I created her, but then moved on.
That's voiceover artist Nikki Thomas. Natalie Nixon, the author and creativity strategist I was talking to earlier, would agree with Nikki. Creativity will give humans a leg up on the AI competition. And how do you define creativity? Because, you know, sometimes we think of creativity as somebody painting a beautiful picture or somebody making a statue. But what is creativity to you?
I define creativity as our ability to toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems and produce novel value. To be an incredible scientist, entrepreneur, teacher, plumber, farmer, etc., requires an immense amount of creativity, an immense amount of ability to toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems. And wonder is awe, audacity, asking big blue sky what if questions. It is making time and space for that. Rigor is about discipline and time on task and incessant practice. And it's not sexy, and it's often very solitary.
So I just got an ad on Instagram. You know how you get bombarded with all these different ads. And the product that I saw was a laundry detergent, but it's in the shape of a piece of paper. And you throw this piece of paper into your wash and voila, it functions as laundry detergent, right? And I was thinking about that as you described your formula for creativity, because we wouldn't necessarily think about creativity in the space of laundry detergents, but it does come into play, right?
Absolutely. That's a great example. And I interviewed over 50 people who come from so many diverse areas and sectors, from beauty and cosmetics, from consulting, the law and legal sector, our family plumber, farmers. And for example, the online bra company Third Love introduced an incredible amount of creativity. And when Third Love first launched in 2014, a lot of people thought that was crazy to launch a brassiere company that would be totally online, because one of the key elements in a sale with a bra is fit. And so how are you going to, you know, properly fit if it's totally, you know, virtual and online? And so through a lot of interaction with users and a lot of testing, they came up with a fit finder, which is now a signature element of their product. So, you know, creativity, we might have typically thought of only in terms of the design side, but it also comes into play in terms of how are you going to deliver the product in a way that's meaningful and makes sense to the end customer.
What are some questions we have to ask when we're trying to innovate, when we're trying to be creative?
I have really been influenced by the work of Warren Berger. And Warren Berger wrote an amazing book called A More Beautiful Question. And so asking first, why? You know, why have we only hired people from these sorts of schools, right? Or why do we never market to the Southern Hemisphere? So asking why. And then asking, what if? What if we started to hire people who only had a high school diploma, but incredible industry and professional experience? What if we started to sell and market to the Southern Hemisphere? So that's a lot of what's called divergent thinking, asking why and what if, and then ending with convergent thinking and asking how. Well, how might we start to hire people from a totally different realm than we typically look at, tapping into a different well, and how might we start to market and sell to, say, Brazil? Who do we know there, right? So it's all about asking the questions. And one of the things that Warren Berger reminds us of is that asking questions is actually a way of thinking.
How do companies create an environment where employees feel empowered to think creatively and to ask lots of questions?
It really, and so this is something that we hear a lot, but it really does depend on leadership. But I'll take it a step further and say when I'm talking about leadership, I'm not only speaking of top-down leadership in an organization, but what I would call emergent leadership. So there are leaders in our organizations that are on the margins oftentimes, are junior-level staffers of an organization, that because of their perspective that they're bringing in to play are offering untapped potential for us to integrate creativity. A lot of companies today like to say, oh, we embrace mistakes, right? But people still kind of have, well, I'm going to wait and see about that. I want to really put my job on the line, right? So moving away from micromanagement and a permission slip culture, you know, organizations are organisms and are made up of humans.
As a single human living in the age of robots, so to speak, what are some things that I can do to stay relevant, to make sure I don't become obsolete?
One is to become a clumsy student of something, anything, right? So, for example, I am currently a clumsy student of several things, of the tango and the foxtrot dance forms. And my stepdaughter gifted me for Mother's Day some pickling jars. Now, the first time I tried pickling, I made so many mistakes. I was really nervous. I didn't want to misstep. But what I found is I had to ask a lot of questions. I did my own research of looking at different websites to figure out different recipes. I improvised. I learned that I should not, in fact, mix red cabbage with broccoli and onion and carrots because the entire jar will turn magenta, right? And I really had to intuit my way through it. And what that does is it rewires the neural synapses in my brain and all of our brains when we are clumsy students. And we take that kind of new neural confidence into our work environments to shift perspective, to be more confident about asking questions when we are clumsy students. It's really about maintaining this appetite for curiosity.
Natalie Nixon is a creativity strategist and the president of Figure Eight Thinking. Her new book is called Creativity Leap: Unleash Curiosity, Improvisation, and Intuition at Work.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the future of work. Millions of people started to work from home during this pandemic, which is a major shift that happened really quickly. Researchers have been looking at this moment in global labor history like a field experiment. What do we know about working from home, and what could we learn from this? Will we ever go back to the office? Pulse reporter Jad Slaman loves working from home and looked into this.
For me, work from home has kind of been a wonderland. Sure, there's the gnawing dread of a major public health crisis and the economic impact. I worry about my health and losing my job, but I have my cat. I have my piano. I have vodka and a PlayStation right here at what's become work. I do interviews in my yard on a milk crate wearing the same shirt I've worn all week. I record stories, this one included, in my closet. I don't set an alarm most days, waking mostly when the sunbeam creeps from my floor to my pillow. I've also felt more focused, more productive, and I've actually produced more stories than usual during this time. It's incredible, and I very honestly never want it to end. So I set out to see, well, does it have to? Should it? I started by talking to Stanford economics professor Nicholas Bloom. He first started looking into work from home back in 2011 when he found out the unassuming middle-aged Asian student in back of his class was the founding CEO of a giant Chinese company.
It was quoted at that time on NASDAQ, worth about $15 billion.
The company was Ctrip, a Chinese travel booking service akin to Expedia or Priceline. At the time, it had 15,000 employees. The student was entrepreneur James Liang.
James himself was worth like I don't know, half a billion. I looked him up online, and it the first hit that came up was China's 500 richest people, and he was definitely not 500 either.
During a class discussion, James said his company was thinking about work from home. They were expanding and feeling growing pains.
They were paying a fortune for this huge office in downtown Shanghai.
The question for C-Trip wasn't, are we going to take a loss during work from home? It was how big of a loss it would be. Is work from home going to save us enough in rent money to be worth it on balance?
So their view was, yeah, some share of people would start watching the Chinese version of Jerry Springer or Oprah Winfrey or set up their own eBay online firm. You know, the saying is the three great enemies of working from home are the fridge, the television, and the bed.
Nicholas was intrigued. He'd been studying what he called, quote, being nice to people, work policies, and asked James if he could tag along back to China and see how it all played out as part of a study. James had lived and worked in the U.S., and his Shanghai offices turned out to be very American.
Cubicles, you know, canteens, 6-7 floors, probably 3,000-4,000 people in that office.
The daily grind was typical office work, phone calls with clients, dealing with web issues. The company did a pseudo-pilot study of work from home with only 5 employees, and the results were promising.
People worked harder because their parents made them work harder.
Armed with that insight, C-Trip scaled up, asked for volunteers to work from home, and got some 500.
We took the 500 and you randomized them by even and odd birthdays. So people with even birthdays, so if you're born on like the 2nd, the 4th, the 6th, the 8th of the month, go home for 9 months and the odds stay in the office.
So 9 months of travel booking later, Nicholas had the results.
The firm was like amazed. It was not remotely what they're expecting.
When they crunched the numbers, it turned out the homebodies were 13% more productive than the office workers. It was easy to tell by looking at booking numbers, client calls. To put that all in perspective, it's like each and every one of them was working a Saturday half day every week at no cost.
They calculated they were increasing profits by about $2,000 for each employee that was working from home.
Nicholas looked into where the boost came from. First off, 9-to-5 actually became 9-to-5. Workers worked their full hours.
And the reason is, you know, they weren't hit by commuting problems or their motorbike broke down or they took a long lunch break or they had to leave early to go to the doctors at home. There was much less of those interruptions.
There was much less of any kind of interruption.
They were just more productive per minute, and they said it was quieter and easier to concentrate.
An important caveat here is the volunteers had spare rooms that they could dedicate to work. It's a luxurious solitude not everyone forced into working from home has right now. I'm lucky enough to live alone, only having to deal with my cat begging me to throw her ball. Nicholas, on the other hand, has human children in his workplace.
My youngest is 4. She regularly, I mean, like, this is like 5 to 10 times a day, comes into my office shouting, doo-doo, doo-doo, which is her nickname for me, you know. I'm bored, I want to play, come with me. And then I say, I've got a phone call, I have to work. And she's like, why do you have to work? And I say, daddy has to earn money. Why do you need the money? I have money. She has this like pot of, you know, cents and 2 cents and nickels and dimes.
In his research on C-Trip, Dudu also found way fewer people quit, which was noteworthy since the company had pretty high churn at the time. It seems to suggest that once people started working from home, they started enjoying their jobs more. That's been true for me during these past few months of working from home, and I think it has to do with what I can do when I'm not working. I can take naps.
So I'm just gonna go ahead and set an alarm.
I don't think I've ever gotten so much sleep in my adult life. And sleep scientist Sarah Alger tells me I probably needed it.
Interestingly, if you subjectively measure it, you ask somebody, do you feel tired? Do you feel like you're not performing at your best? A lot of times they're very inaccurate.
Sarah works at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research.
Oh no, I'm fine. I had 4 hours of sleep last night, but I'm great. But then you objectively test them and no, they're not great. They are really showing impairments in their performance.
I tell her about this joyless, solemn cup of coffee I used to have every day in the office pre-pandemic, right around 2 p.m. I got it from our office machine, piping hot, and put in a few ice cubes just to down it like a kid taking cough medicine. Without it, I would get this crazy urge to nap under my desk that I'd have to fight for the rest of the day. Sarah says I was fighting nature.
your circadian cycle has a natural dip in the afternoon. And so a lot of people think this is the post-lunch dip and it has to do with them having had a big lunch, but it's really the natural dip in your circadian rhythm when both your homeostatic pressure or need for sleep and your circadian dip in alertness coincide. That's just the best time to try to get one in there.
Sarah's been pushing naps in the workplace for years.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that when you go to sleep, it's not like a computer. So you're not shutting your brain off. The brain is actually very active.
She breaks it down for me. A short power nap, like 20 minutes, gives your brain something caffeine cannot.
Sleep spindles.
They're bursts of brain waves that last half a second or so. You can actually see muscle twitching associated with it.
That are thought to help reactivate memory traces.
The more you remember, the more you learn. Sarah says napping is good for companies. It can boost productivity and problem solving, and it's got these real health benefits for employees. But even if you're not into napping, working from home could mean that you could use your time more effectively under any circumstance.
I mean, being British, you know, many times I've come into work with a stinking hangover and, you know, by 2 p.m, I'm done. So then the question is, if I'm in the office, I kind of feel like I should stick around. If I'm at home, quite honestly, I just, you know, clock off.
That's Nicholas Bloom again from Stanford.
I can actually productively use that time. I can maybe go clean or do the laundry or, you know, go for a run.
That's not the kind of thing you can do when you're working in an office. When my brain was fried, I would just scroll through bits of Reddit I'd already seen or stare at YouTube videos on autoplay. Nicholas says it's okay for our brains to need breaks.
There's only so much energy, I believe, your brain can put into allowing you to concentrate.
He says work from home lets us just kind of accept that and fall into a more natural rhythm of work and rest.
So my day is structured slightly differently. I start earlier, work for a bit, go for a run, work for a while, actually see my kids over dinner in the early evening, and then sometimes work a bit later at night.
Talking work from home with Nicholas, it sounded like all this was a win-win all around. But then he tells me about what happened after the C-Trip study.
End of the 9-month experiment, when they rolled it out to the entire firm, 50% of the original group that volunteered to go home and had been at home for 9 months decided they wanted to come back into the office. You know, the big complaint was loneliness and depression.
It turned out that, especially among the younger workers, being home meant this social loss. Nicholas says work for them was this important part of their social lives.
So, you know, if you're born in Philly and go to a university in New York and you're working, say, in San Francisco, you may not know a lot of people in San Francisco, and your workplace is a key part of your social life. And if you're cut off from it, it's painful, actually.
Nicholas's study found choice is hugely important when it comes to work from home. With C-Trip, after the workers who wanted to go back to the office left the experimental group, the productivity of the hardcore homebodies on average actually rose again to 25%, like they were working full Saturdays every week. So there's a real case for permanent work from home for some people. Laura Hambly is an organizational and industrial psychologist who tries to figure out who those people are. To figure out if work from home will work, Laura uses a kind of personality test. Introverts, perhaps unsurprisingly, do very well. For them, just being at work takes work.
It's because there's people all around, and there's interruptions and conversations, and they may like people, but they need to recharge from that. So they feel kind of, when they're working from home, it's kind of a dream for them in terms of they get that focus, they get the time on their own.
That's kind of me. After 2 years on the job, I can count my water cooler conversations on one hand. Laura also found confident workers thrive as well, those with high task confidence, as in you don't typically need to ask a colleague to look over your work.
So someone who's new in their career and just starting their very first job and then COVID hits and they're not a confident person to begin with, this would be difficult. Remote work would put them in a very awkward situation.
She found, though, that most people are somewhere in the middle, most productive with a few days in the office and a few at home, which jibes coincidentally with what public health experts want in the new normal: staggered shifts, reduced occupancy. The bottom line, though, she says, is most people won't know until they try it. If there's any silver lining in this mass work from home experience, it's that more people are trying it, forced to get over this fear.
It's fear that people aren't productive, but you should be able to know whether people are productive based on how you evaluate their performance and how you measure performance, regardless of whether you see them or not.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. This question of productivity, what workers are doing when they're not in the office, how much they are getting done, it's been on a lot of employers' minds. And some companies are actually checking up on their employees with surveillance technology. Camille Peterson has more.
When Bennett Seifer started researching what he calls bossware, that software for monitoring workers, one thing in particular really started to creep him out: the way companies that make this software market the product.
They'll just come out and say, oh, do you want to get your employees' private social media passwords? We can help. It's like, what? There's a whole world that we sort of stumbled into.
Bennett is a staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a digital privacy nonprofit. He says this software is a lot like spyware. It's on your computer, and it monitors everything. That work laptop you're on right now, it could have this software on it, and you wouldn't know.
It lives in the background of your computer. It tracks your keystrokes, takes screenshots, tracks what applications you use, and reports all of that to your manager or to your IT department.
There are degrees of how intense this software is. The least intense, a log of every application and website you use. Then, somewhere in the middle, software that tracks your keystrokes and mouse clicks to give a minute-by-minute breakdown of your day, or take screenshots of your computer without you knowing. And the most intense, software that can secretly turn on your camera and microphone.
It's almost as if there's like a red recording light on in the corner of your screen all the time.
I checked out the websites of companies that sell this software. Many argue remote workplaces need this technology. And I talked to Reed Blackman. He's a business ethics consultant. He told me before the pandemic, clients didn't really ask him about this software. Now they do.
People are working from home more than ever for obvious reasons. Revenues are often declining. And you need to keep track of cost. And one thing you want to make sure is that you're not spending money on employees who aren't doing anything.
Reed says managers usually have some concerns that using the software might damage trust or violate privacy, but they don't really know what else to do.
And then the worry is that they just get a tool and then they just deploy it and there's not enough talk with managers and employees about what's being done, why it's being done, and the role that it's playing in the assessment of employees.
I talked to a worker who is worried about the way his company has handled monitoring software. He asked to remain anonymous out of fear of punishment from his employer, but he works at a bank in Alabama that is now working from home. He says his company started using an app that automatically records every phone call an employee makes and lets managers listen in real time.
And then it'll send logs every day with how much time we spent on the phone, how long the average phone call was, what times they were made, the numbers that we called, and all of that.
He says the monitoring and the fear of more of it has already taken a toll.
Now it's very much feeling like we're just a cog here to make the company money. And it's taken some of the magic out of what we do and why we do it. And I don't see it being sustainable long term for a lot of people.
Workplace surveillance isn't just part of the future for people who have desk jobs. It's also pervasive in warehouse jobs and for gig workers like Uber drivers and delivery people. Willie Solis lives in a suburb outside of Dallas, Texas. Since fall, he's been a shopper for the grocery delivery service Shipt.
Welcome to the ranks of the Shipt shopper pilots. Now that you have successfully navigated...
We accept orders on an app and we'll go to the grocery store to go purchase items for customers and then deliver whatever it is to the customer.
Willie feels like the app tracks him all the time, even when he's not on a job. And he's heard from other workers about the app asking to turn on phone cameras and Shipt workers being watched and reported at grocery stores for things like teaming up with other shoppers.
What does it feel like to kind of be in a situation where you're being monitored like that all the time when you're working?
It's
it drives paranoia into you for sure. It's like, you know, Big Brother monitoring you when you go into every single store that you go into.
A Shipp spokesperson said shoppers can adjust the settings on the app, including location sharing and camera access, and said Shipp does not proactively ask retailers to monitor shopper behavior. But surveillance in gig work is pretty unavoidable. The apps that get you from job to job become a kind of overzealous boss.
Surveillance, control, all of the different kinds of things that we associate with in-person bosses, the algorithms are doing also.
Julia Tacona is a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. She researches how workers interact with technology, and she says coronavirus has opened a brave new world in worker surveillance. On online caregiver marketplaces, care workers are now asked to monitor and report their temperatures. It's optional information, but Julia says it can feel pretty coercive.
It is kind of framed as like another way to brand yourself as being a desirable worker, potentially, for a family.
And Julia says there's a troubling imbalance in this health surveillance. Only workers are asked for it, not employers. This is something that worries Ali Al-Khatib about our work futures. Ali researches data ethics at the University of San Francisco.
In-person environments might have made it easier to look around and see that all of us are being oppressed in certain ways, or that I'm being singled out in certain ways. Technology makes it very easy for a system to sort of put up a wall.
Ali says the pandemic has pushed workplace surveillance into overdrive. So he says we have to start having conversations now about our future workplaces, what we're okay with, and what we cannot tolerate.
That was Camille Peterson reporting. What are we okay with in our workplaces? What's not okay? When we have these conversations about work, maybe we should dig a bit deeper and think about the role of work in our lives. Is it drudgery or fun? A paycheck or a calling? Something that contributes meaning? Maybe it's all of the above. Philosophy professor Jennifer Baker from the College of Charleston talks about these things with her students, and she usually starts the conversation with a few questions. For example, have you had a job that involved physical labor?
Like a janitorial job, the pay wasn't great.
But still, you worked really hard. And then Jennifer asks stuff like,
if they vacuumed a corner that looked clean while nobody was watching.
She asks these questions to get her students to think about their work ethic and to introduce them to the ideas of German sociologist Max Weber. In the early 20th century, Weber wrote an influential book that argued that modern capitalism was influenced heavily by Protestant ideas about the importance of work, that it was pious to work hard. But then Weber said these ideas were stripped of a deeper meaning.
He calls it, you know, the ghosts of a religious idea.
Weber argued that people had internalized these religious ideas about work, tying work to morality, without actually believing that hard work would lead to eventual salvation.
It meant that people worked as if they had an obligation to, without having a justification for that. So sometimes I notice, you know, we think work ethic and we think it's a positive. You know, we would like a work ethic. We want to improve our work ethic. But Weber's description of it is really sad, actually. And he thinks it's kind of an impossible set of ideas, and it takes meaning from our life.
Now, Jennifer is not suggesting that there is anything wrong with working hard or enjoying work. But in the spirit of Weber, she wants us to think about why we work so hard.
Are we doing the work that we do out of a duty to our employer? Do we feel it makes us kind of cleaner and better to have put in a day of work? Are we really being rewarded with it? You know, are we honoring all our skills and abilities in our work life, if it's all-consuming, what are we doing it for?
I think of myself as a hard worker, and I've always taken pride in that. So it feels a little scary to challenge that. In the absence of religion, which many people are not religious, work imbues meaning into our lives in a way that
yes.
We don't question. And lately I have joked about committing what I call radical acts of irresponsibility, which in my case would be like not filling the ice cube tray or something right, silly like so that. Great. But I do think, you know, I think in terms of like, if I really think about it, if I were to be irresponsible or I would not do a task or I would just not complete something that I said I was going to do, the terrifying undercurrent under that is that perhaps my work doesn't have meaning and then I don't have meaning and my life doesn't have meaning.
Yeah, right. Wow.
So it can get really big really quick, yes, you know, when right. you start questioning, like, why do I show up every day?
Right, right. It's not just a means to an end. You know, it's not, Faber did describe, he thought it was more normal or less ideological when people would work and then kind of blow all their money as soon as they were paid. You know, I mean, he thought the standard human would only work for benefits. And then he saw this work ethic where people were working for more than benefits, but for psychological reasons. Because he had this idea that what you did could be regarded as kind of cleaning your soul, if that makes sense. So if you go to a filthy place, you'll be infected a bit by that. If you go to a very orderly office, you know, with desks in a row and everyone dressed in the same uniform way, it kind of cleans your soul a bit.
Jennifer says the pandemic could be an impetus to think about the role of work in our lives. For example, the fact that so many of us have struggled to get along with family members now that we work from home and spend so much time together.
This is a harsh take, but, you know, virtue ethics would suggest that that probably means we were distracting ourselves with work and not working on those relationships. You know, there are many temptations to distract ourselves, and being away from our most crucial relationships is a way to not have to, you know, adjust yourself to them. So I feel like it could be a very positive influence in people's lives, a way to get them to focus on what really matters. You know, at the end of people's lives, they talk a lot about relationships they didn't always invest all their time and energy into while they were focusing on their career. And it seems like that type of perspective could be valuable to many of us.
Yeah, I guess because it always feels like, well, I have to get back to work. I have to get back to work. I can't deal with you right yeah. now. You know?
Right.
But yes, maybe right. it's more like I should work on this relationship.
You. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Jennifer Baker is a professor of philosophy at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a YouTuber. It's like I make videos of me playing video games.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the future of work, and much of that future will be shaped by the next generation of workers. What do they want to accomplish? Last year, in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, Lego hired a polling company to ask kids what they want to be when they grow up. Well, if they were expecting the answer to be astronaut, they got a surprise. 30% of respondents said they wanted to be YouTubers, three times the number of kids who wanted to be astronauts. What do these aspirations tell us? And should we be worried? Sonia Swanson looked into that.
We all remember answering the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? Now it was my turn to ask, starting with a few of my friends' kids, who are all in grade school.
I like to paint rainbows and flowers, and I want to be an artist when I grow up. And I want to play the piano.
I actually have two things I want to be. Well, technically three, but I want to be a YouTuber, a game designer, and an engineer.
I want to
work at McDonald's.
Well, if you were not going to work at McDonald's, what kinds of other jobs do you think that you would like to do?
Oh, I want to be a rich gamer. It's like I make videos of me playing video games.
I want to be a guitar player because then I get famous.
I would like to be a YouTuber. I'm very inspired by YouTubers because they make lots of views and they give you confidence when you're watching them.
So I either want to be an art teacher or someone who makes video games.
That's a pretty fun mix. So what might be motivating those career aspirations?
You know, if you look at 8 or 9 to 12-year-olds, social status, prestige becomes so important in their lives that's how they're going to filter much of the information they see and the experiences they have.
That's Jay Rajeski, a professor of education at the University of Georgia. Jay says that children's occupational aspirations first reflect size, what they see as large, like a fire truck. And then it starts to conform to social expectations, like gender norms.
And so part of what you see there is also just society's kind of hierarchy of what's okay and what's not okay. And that's always been a concern to me too, because we put so much value on your worth as an individual based upon your career.
Jay says as kids become older, they become more aware of their interests, talents, and options.
Start to understand, here's who I am, here's what I like, here's the kind of opportunities I might have.
Why do you think so many adults are worried that kids say they want to be YouTubers, and like, should we be worried? Like, are kids going to actually, are we going to have like a population of 30% YouTubers in 30 years?
You know, if these were 25-year-olds saying, I want to be a YouTuber and I don't want to be anything else, maybe we should, you know, think twice about it. But in early adolescence, I think that's what they see.
With younger kids, Jay says adults can keep an open mind. Rather than saying that's a bad choice, grown-ups can help kids figure out how to actually go about realizing that dream, because that process in itself is a skill.
It's increasingly less important what we want to do in our lives, and it's increasingly more important that we know how to do it. So the notion of being adaptable, being aware of opportunities, being prepared when chance events might occur in your life, being able to manage your own career.
All of these abilities, Jay says, are going to be more important than ever, because what we adults think of as a traditional career might already be outdated.
In the gig economy, more part-time jobs, international work, you know, 24/7, all these kinds of issues are changing, I think, the way careers are happening. Yet we still kind of think in the old ways of a career is you start, you work for 30 years, you retire. And it's very different.
In other words, we can all stop with the hand-wringing and let kids imagine a future where they are YouTubers or rock stars or servers at McDonald's. It's the imagining itself that makes space for possible futures.
What kinds of jobs do you think we're going to have in the future?
Maybe one will be like, you know how some people are racers in cars? Maybe there will be floating cars someday.
That was Sonia Swanson reporting. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.